This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Millennials, those aged 18 to 35, have had a terrible time at saving money for retirement. That age group is the only one with a negative savings rate. And not that it's been the greatest climate for those younger adults to save, entering the job market during an economic downturn, amassing student loans that have to be repaid, and finding their upward career paths blocked by baby boomers who are staying on the job longer. We talk with Sarah Holden, Senior Director, Retirement and Investor Research with the Investment Company Institute, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimio about ways millennials can boost their savings and how parents can help their adult children better prepare for their financial futures. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Chris, starting us off, though, it's the first Friday of the month, which means that we get a look at the employment figures for the last month. How did those turn out?
Well, unfortunately, for the market at least today, they were better than expected. So much better, in fact. They were looking for non-farm payrolls to grow by about 225,000. And what we got was 295,000. And that was strong enough to take the wind out of the Fed isn't going to be raising interest rates anytime soon sales. And that's what started a sell-off. It was almost instant once they realized that this might actually be such good news. So there are certain parts of the market that are doing all right today. The financial services sector is doing well. Some of the retailers are doing okay because they're with more jobs. There could be more money circulating through the economy. But, you know, the rest of the market, maybe not so hot. But that really kind of brings us to our topic, though, Mark, namely that here you look at a day like today, the Dow Jones Industrials, as we hit on the air at 1:34 this Friday afternoon, are down 251 points. And back in the old days, people would look at that and say, oh, my gosh, the sky is falling. Another plague. First the snow, then the ice, and now this. Yeah. Well, the fact is that you can look at any given day, on any given week, any given month, any given year, and find a perfectly good excuse not to take care of your financial future. It makes no difference what day, week, month, year it is. There's always a reason to postpone taking care of your inevitable self. And that's why we have Sarah Holden with us today. Sarah's with that Investment Company Institute, which has been around. This is its 75th anniversary. And they are the clearinghouse of information for the mutual fund industry. Sarah's been at this for a long, long time. And Sarah, are you with us, Sarah?
Yes, I am.
Good. Thanks so much. What's the weather like in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's a beautiful sunny day today, but we've got a lot of snow on the ground, which we don't cope
well
with.
Sounds like Cincinnati.
Yeah, we're notorious for bad driving. There are pictures of bad drivers, of the results of people's bad driving here. Well, thanks for joining us, because hopefully you'll, in the next 25 minutes or so, you're going to be able to help us, help our listeners navigate through the treacherous world, or sometimes treacherous world of investing. The ICI, the Investment Company Institute, manages but keeps track of an industry that's how many trillions of dollars now?
Yeah, so the Investment Company Institute, we represent the mutual fund industry and ETFs, and so our members are managing about $18 trillion in assets. Most of that is in mutual funds, although $2 trillion of it is in exchange-traded funds. And there's more than 90 million individual shareholders holding those funds.
Hey, Sarah, can you kind of explain the difference between a mutual fund and an exchange-traded fund? Because I think it's important to understand the whole concept of there are these different options that you can invest in out there.
Yeah, so there's many different options. And so mutual funds are a pooled investment product where you basically you'll pick your mutual fund based on whether you want to invest in equities or bonds, or you might want to invest in a money market fund. And so the mutual fund manager pools together all these investors' assets and invests them on the behalf of those investors. And you are able to trade those funds at a price at the close of the day. The main difference between the ETFs or the exchange-traded funds and the mutual funds is that with an exchange-traded fund, you can exchange it during the day. So it's something that's on an exchange, and you can buy and sell ETF shares during the day, whereas with the mutual fund, it's an overnight operation, basically.
ETFs typically aren't managed either, are they?
Well, the ETFs, for the most part, they are index, but there are some actively managed ETFs. So for the most part, you're right, they are index assets, so mostly sort of something like an S&P 500 index fund. But you can also get an S&P 500 mutual fund.
Interestingly, Sarah, the exchange-traded fund world, I think, was pretty new, and I mean relatively new compared to the world of mutual funds, which goes back to the 1920s. But the funds trading on an exchange that were index funds, as the modern version of it, go back, I think, to 1993 or 1994, when a version of the Standard & Poor's 500 index became available. And it went from zero to, again, you said that the ETF world is trillions of dollars now.
Chris, you know, we were...
Yeah, they've really grown. So you're right. They were sort of the newer kid on the block. And over the past decade or so, we've got nearly $2 trillion in ETFs at this point.
Wow.
You know, we were talking earlier about the difficulties of saving for millennials. Mark Zandi's comment, I think, is what touched off a lot of this. He said it during National Savings Week that their savings rate is underwater. Do you have a valid point about the difficulties that millennials face in saving for their futures?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons we have Sarah with us today, because the Investment Company Institute, along with the EBRI, which is, Sarah, you said that's the Employee Benefit Research Institute?
Yes, that's right.
They've done tremendous amounts of studies on savings habits of people at various ages. What has your work led you to believe? What are the main impediments to the millennials saving as much as they should be?
Well, I think we need to step back on when we want to think about how millennials are doing and remember that saving for retirement, there's a life cycle to it. So when you're a younger household, you're going to have other things to focus on than retirement per se. So, for example, you may be focusing on saving for and paying for education. Now, that's something that's going to give you a better job, a better career, and then a better retirement. You may be focused on saving for a home, and that's going to give you a house that you can live in while you're working, and then you can live in it while you're retired. So it's a great resource for retirement as well. But education and the home aren't things that are earmarked for retirement, so people don't always think about them when they're thinking about, are millennials preparing for retirement? They may be focused on the home or on education. The other thing we have to keep track of when we think about saving for retirement is Social Security, which is a key component to Americans' retirement security. And that's something that from your very first job, you start building that Social Security record. And then finally, we get to the piece that most people focus on when they think about saving for retirement, and that's the plans that are either offered by your employer or individual retirement accounts. And here's where we've done a lot of research looking at, you know, how are millennials doing with those 401k plans or those IRAs, you know, compared to the generations that came before them. So I just want to give you a statistic that actually comes out of the Federal Reserve Board's Survey of Consumer Finances. And this is the other important point to make, too, is if you want to compare the millennials to the baby boom, you want to do it for the same age, because the baby boom, now they're older. They're in their peak earning savings years. They're really geared up to and focused on saving for retirement. You wouldn't want to compare how many of them are saving for retirement or have an account now to the millennials, because millennials are much younger. What you want to do is say, well, when the baby boom was back in their, 20s or late 20s, early 30s is the statistic I have, what percentage of them had a defined contribution plan account? That would be a 401k or an IRA. And the answer is about 20%. So about 1 in 5 baby boomers, when they were young, had started saving in a DC account or IRA. And if we look at the millennials, we actually see that about half of them already have one of those types of accounts.
Really? Half of millennials?
Mm-hmm.
So more of them are saving, but they're not saving as much as their baby boom counterparts?
So now we can look at, we see that a challenge for the millennials may be, getting that job. But once they've got the job, we see that they are indeed saving in their 401k plans. And they're entering the job market with a very different 401k plan than what the baby boom saw when they entered the job market. So 401k plans now are really geared up to be the primary retirement savings vehicle for folks. When you are a millennial, you start your job, chances are you'll be offered a 401k. Chances are also that if you're at a large company, they may have automatic enrollment. And what that will do is you won't have to make any decisions at all other than to say, I'll just let them put me on the path of saving for retirement. So I will let them automatically enroll me. The plan will then start you saving at a certain percentage of your salary. It's often 3%. And then they'll put you in an investment. It's often a target date fund. And that's a fund that's diversified. So it has stocks and bonds in it. And it's geared so that it rebalances over time as you get older and as you approach retirement. It shifts its investment focus away from growth and towards income so that as you get to retirement, you'll have the income to come out of that fund.
Interesting. You know, Sarah, one of the things that you pointed out when we were talking earlier, and I have noticed this for a long time, is that the Investment Company Institute has a website that is just chock full of resources for anyone looking for information on what to expect from the investment world with respect to mutual funds. It's ICI.org. And under the resources tab, one of your pieces here under the resources tab talks about the typical mutual fund shareholder. And this number, and you've archived all these reports. So the most recent one, which was released this year, covers mutual fund shareholders from 2014. And actually, it says here that 15% of mutual fund shareholders were millennials. But if you slice it and dice it another way, that 17% of households headed by people under age 35 own mutual funds, and another 35% or so own funds who are between 33 and 54. In other words, kind of the late millennials, early boomer types. So what does that really say then about who's investing in funds and the extent to which they're using these in their retirement plans differently than they did, say, 30 years ago?
So what we see when we look at our, we do a big household survey each year, so we talk to them on the phone and find out whether they have mutual funds and whether they have defined contribution plans and whether they have individual retirement accounts. And a trend that we've seen over time is that commonly the way that an individual is introduced to a mutual fund investing or to investing in general is through that 401k plan at work. So it's when you get your first job, you sign up for the 401k or you're automatically enrolled in that 401k. And then there's all these educational materials in the plan to explain saving and investing, investing being, well, let's look at stocks versus bonds and figure out how comfortable you are with risk versus return. And so what we see is that many mutual fund-owning households are indeed introduced to mutual funds through that defined contribution plan at work. The numbers that you were just talking about show the composition of mutual fund-owning households, and the biggest group is actually the baby boom generation, and because they're older and tend to have been saving longer, they tend to hold even more of the assets. But what I think is interesting to look at is what's called the incidence of mutual fund ownership. So if we look at a generation, we ask what percentage of the households in that generation are owning funds. There we see that it's about a third of millennials already own mutual funds. And they're young. These are young folks, but a third of them own mutual funds. And when we look at Generation X and the baby boom, it's about half of them own mutual funds. So the millennial generation, they're a bit younger, and they're just getting introduced to working and saving and investing, but we have a third of them owning funds.
Nice.
Sarah, we got a comment from Ellie on Facebook. She makes a very good point that for many millennials, it's hard to save when student loan interest rates keep going up. And what kind of advice do you have for pulling that off? How do you handle student loans and other debt while saving ahead for the future?
Yeah, so this is a challenge that households face, and as a younger household, there will be those pressures of you've got to take care of that education. You want to get that education so that you can get yourself on a good career path, and so that may be the first best thing to take care of is to pay down those loans. You also may be looking to get a house, and all of these things that even though they're not earmarked or specially labeled as saving for retirement, they're things that are going to put your household just in a better financial position overall. And then later when you're older and you've, you know, gotten to your second job and your salaries have gone up, then you can start earmarking even more for retirement. And in fact, the rules recognize that people often really focus on saving for retirement mid to later in life. And actually, if you're 50 or older, there's what are called catch-up contributions that you can put in extra money into your IRA or into your 401k plan because policymakers recognize that some folks are going to need to catch up at that point. And that's a point where they can catch up. You know, if they've taken care of their own education, their children's education, they're in a pretty good place in terms of the house, and now they can really devote much more resources to putting aside for retirement, so let's let them do that.
I wonder if that was introduced by then-Senator Hines. Sorry. The catch-up. Sorry about that.
Catch-up?
Yeah, the catch-up provisions. You know, it's interesting, too, because remember that 401k plans didn't exist until the early 1980s. They grew out of one of the Reagan-era tax reform acts. And so these 401k plans kind of grew as they were called CODA, cash or deferred arrangements, where people would add money out of their own pocket onto an existing plan, and then they became standalone. So in the 401k world, more frequently you see employer matches where employers not wanting their plans to get top-heavy and potentially run into difficulty with too much money being put in by too few people. They encourage people who are just getting started to contribute. And one of the ways to do that is to have an employer match. What percentage, Sarah Holden, at the ICI, do you see of plans in your research there and at the Employee Benefit Research Institute, what percentage of 401k plans offer some kind of employer match to an employee's contributions?
Yeah, so a majority of plans do this. Actually, looking at data from the Department of Labor, there's something called the Form 5500, which is a filing that plans have to do. And BrightScope has a database that contains 35,000 401k plans in it. And we looked at that data with them, and we found that basically it's 8 out of 10 401k plans have an employer match. So this is where the employer or employer contribution, the employer puts money into the plan. In 37% of 401k plans, the employer just puts money in whether the employee contributes or not. So this could just be the employer wants to make sure that everybody's got some kind of a nest egg, and they may just put in a flat contribution amount for everybody. We've got some people do what's called a tiered match formula, which is kind of a complicated formula, but what most of them do, 40% of 401k plans do what's called a simple match formula. And that's where if you put in a certain percentage of your salary, the employer will also put in money. And the most common formula is if you put in 6% of your salary, the employer will match 50 cents on the dollar up to that, and so they'll put in another 3% for you. And so just in terms of a thing to keep track of as you are starting a new job and you've just got all the information on your 401k, you want to be sure that you take full advantage of that employer match, because that is money that you will leave on the table and not get if you don't put in the amount to get that full match. So if it's 50 cents on the dollar up to 6%, you want to be sure you put in that 6% so that you can get that full 3% put in as well.
And so even if you can't do the full 6%, you put in 2%, your employer matches 1%. That's still some free money that you're getting that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, that's what you do with
the can. Exactly. So you just want to be sure that you take full advantage of that match. And some people may need to do more. So you also just want to look at the best place to look for information would be on your 401k website. There'll be tools and there'll be things that they'll want to know how old are you, how much have you saved already, and they'll give you an idea of how much you should put in or how much you should save in the plan to try to you know, maintain your standard of living in retirement.
Sarah, we've talked a lot about saving for retirement, but how important is it for millennials to be thinking shorter term, to be saving for more immediate goals, and then what are some ways they can do that?
So when we look at survey U.S. households and ask them about their savings goals, again, this comes out of the Fed's Survey of Consumer Finance, you do find that there's about a third of households, no matter how old they are, who say their primary concern or primary reason for saving is for liquidity, is for a rainy day. And so that's something that is typically done outside of a 401k, which is thought of as a more long-term savings vehicle. Although some folks will use an IRA to save for a house because there is actually an exemption if you take the money out of your IRA to buy a new first home. They won't charge you the penalty on that savings. So, you know, for some of your immediate goals, it's really best to not be thinking about the 401k as something for those immediate goals, but as earmarked for retirement. And this is, you know, as we were talking before, households, you know, depending on how old you are, you know, everyone always has a need for a rainy day fund, and you want to try to be sure you have that so you don't get caught short. And then if you're younger, working on that house, working on that education will put you in a good place so that you can save for retirement. And then as you get to be sort of middle-aged and older, you can really focus in on saving for retirement. And the government even lets you put extra money in your plan once you reach 50, so that by the time you reach retirement, we find that 8 out of 10 households have DC plan assets, IRA assets, or DB plan promises. Most of them actually own their home, and if they don't own it outright, if they still have a bit of a mortgage, it's a very small mortgage typically. And so we find that, you know, households generally, after this life cycle of, you know, taking account of sort of as these things change over your life cycle as you age, reach retirement with the home and the nest egg in place so that they can then retire.
You know, Sarah, you mentioned this to follow up with Mark's question.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people are saving for something like to build up a rainy day fund or to build up money for a home purchase. And right now, with rates as low as they are, many folks, many investors are looking to have a place to put money where it earns more than zero, but they don't want to take the risk of the stock market. And so there's been a lot of money flowing into these short-term bond funds or short-term funds that own credit instruments that are shorter-term in nature, some of which are tax-free and some are not. What have you been seeing at the Investment Company Institute about flows of money into and out of different asset classes, such as from stocks into bonds or from cash into short-term bonds? What have been the trends there?
So when we look at mutual fund flows overall, the things that tend to drive the flows are, first, you know, market returns, because people are looking at market returns. But we've also seen that there's a little bit of a demographic impact going on in terms of fund flows. And there's been, you know, flows into bond funds, which you just mentioned. And some of that's simply because we do have this aging population of this baby boom entering retirement. And as people are entering retirement, they're thinking about that, you know, income generation as opposed to, you know, the appreciation of, you know, like an equity investment. But that said, even our 401k participants in their 60s still do hold equities because just because you're ending your working career, you could have, you know, 30 years in retirement, and you want to be in the market earning returns over, you know, that time frame as well.
Sarah, are there any things that parents should keep in mind, ways that they can help their adult kids with saving more money?
I think in terms of it, sort of the age old, they say, what's the best thing we can do in helping our younger folks in terms of saving for retirement or saving in general? And it sort of goes back to just early on when they're younger, having an allowance and learning that you need to set a budget and you need to, you know, save a little bit aside for that bigger purchase that you might want to get one day or, you know, for a rainy day in case something happens. And just sort of from the very beginning, teaching and learning about don't spend it at the minute it, you know, hits your pocket, but saving some aside for the rainy day or for retirement or, you know, a home or whatever that future longer term goal is.
Yeah, and one of the things that people can do, that our listeners can do to get a little more comfortable with a lot of these concepts, is to go to your website, because it again, as I mentioned earlier, it is just loaded with you know, worksheets, with resource, the 401k Resource Center, education about the different kinds of funds, what target date funds are, what money market funds are, white papers on a number of topics, frequently asked questions, fact books, everything. It's all right there. So before you invest in a mutual fund, stopping at the ICI, the ICI.org website, be a good first place to get some just, you know, neutral information and useful information about what's available.
Chris, how important do you think the concept that Sarah was discussing about starting early, getting early education, starting to save money early, how important is that really?
It's critical. The sooner you start, the longer the period of time you have for the miracle of compound interest to work for you. So starting early is critically important. Sarah, is there information at your website, or is the IC identity work for even younger savers? Do you have any things that are specifically there to help parents teach children or do a you know, transfer information from one generation to another?
Yeah, so most of our information is it's research-based, and so we've got a lot of information. I think where it's the place where most people start saving and investing is through that 401k. I would suggest that just looking at, you know, our information on what does the typical 401k look like, you know, and then you can see, well, how does your 401k compare to that? And you can be sure that you're, you know, taking advantage of the employer match, and then you can think about diversification of your assets and get yourself into, you know, maybe you decide to go with the target date fund, or maybe you're the do-it-yourselfer who's going to pick among the, on average, there's 25 different funds in a 401k plan. So I think that looking at how the different age group shareholders have allocated their assets in the 401k might give you an idea of, well, here's what other people my age did, and give you some sense of, well, am I doing sort of what the others have done, and why am I doing something differently? And that will help you just navigate through that retirement savings space.
Sarah and Chris, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Sarah Holden, Senior Director, Retirement and Investor Research with the Investment Company Institute, and local financial advisor Chris DeSimeo. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. The Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport plays a critical role in the economic vitality of our region, but many have questioned who should have authority over CVG. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll look at possible changes to how the airport is governed. We also explore the history of the first African Americans in the U.S. space program. And in Focus on Technology, a suburban Cincinnati firefighter is shedding new light on safety. That Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.